Hey, Nina. Thanks for coming on the podcast today. I'm excited to talk to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're a very interesting and wonderful person, and you do so much cool things in your life, right? You're an author, you're a spiritual teacher, you're a yogi, you're a master Reiki practitioner, you lead retreats, all these really fancy schmancy cool things. But I think it all comes down to, you know, just being helping people find their path and find what means the most to them in their lives. And that must be a very rewarding, you know, career choice, I suppose. How did you get into this?
It is quite rewarding. I feel like work is honestly one of the most joyful parts of my life, and I know how unique that is. So I feel really grateful every day that I get to do what I do and do what I love so much. Thank you for all those fun reflections. Sure. You know, I would say I got into a lot of these different pieces in a lot of different ways, but if I were to sum it up into, you know, one sentence, I would say that I got into the work that I do because it's also the work that I needed. Mm-hmm. And there was something in my curiosity when I started to more deeply discover myself and become really curious about why I was responding to the world in the way that I was and what I could do to create a deeper sense of presence and enjoyment and fulfillment just out of my own life. Every time I would visit a practice or a healer or a mentor or really anything, it was never just with the intention of receiving it. I was always wanting to reverse engineer everything that was happening. So right. I'd be with my mentor and I'd be like, okay, why'd you just ask me that? What are you doing right now? I'm feeling something over here. Are you doing that? What's happening? So I really have this insatiable curiosity that I think really led me to being an epic teacher, because I love to, you know, understand really deeply. And I also love to distill and articulate in a way that people can really metabolize and digest.
Right. And it's something that people are certainly drawn to as well, right? Is that they can sense that in a person when even just how you speak and how you conduct yourself, you know, there's something about it that draws people in, right? And so when you start doing your own work, as you say, and you start being able to explain what's going on, and potentially that opens the door to then being able to help other people, right, with the same sort of thing. And so it's a very interesting situation, for lack of a better word. But so, you know, what kind of people are most drawn to come see you? Is it those looking to understand themselves better, you know, make a better life for themselves? What's that like?
Yeah, the range is really wide. I mean, I have people who come to me because they've done a lot of therapy or personal development work, or they've worked with a coach and they feel like there's just something else, something bigger, something deeper, or even something specific, like a big trauma that they're looking to be free of, or a consistent pattern they're aware of that they would like freedom from. Mm-hmm. Some people come just because they feel a resonance, similarly to what you just explained so beautifully. You know, some people follow me on social media and they read what I write, and there's a part of them that just says, okay, you get it, so can you help me? And I'm like, right. Well, usually. So there really is a range, but I would say most often it's people who have already undergone a lot of spiritual curiosity and a lot of personal development, people who have, you know, done the meditations and worked with some sort of emotional processing of some sort, and they want to create more community around what they've uncovered. They want to learn to actually implement and use the knowledge that they've acquired, because it's one thing to know the things. It's a different thing to really live them and to experience the tools that you have really delivering results and working in your life. And I find that that's where a lot of people get stuck. There's so much information out there. Like, you can learn almost anything if you want, but knowing it and truly learning it for me is different. You know, it's the difference between mentally understanding and actually embodying a truth. And I'm really watching a wave of people who want the second part. They want not just to know what works and the how and the why. They want results. We want to feel different. We want to experience something being different in our life. And that's really what I like to do, is help people actually use what a lot of us already know in a way that changes the way that they meet the world and the way that the world meets them too.
Right. It's very interesting that you say that, because there is so much information out there, particularly in the sort of self-help world, right? And a lot of it, I mean, sure, a lot of it's good information. I'm not saying it's bad, but if you overload yourself on information, you kind of run into that like decision paralysis situation, right? Or option paralysis, maybe it's called, where there's so many different things and they kind of conflict, although perhaps not rarely, but it can certainly seem like there's a lot of conflict between the different theories of how you should live your life, or the best way to optimize this or that part of yourself, or to, you know, work through this or that. And I mean, I guess the literature is available so broadly because it resonates differently with different people. And so there is that element, which is good. But if you're not exactly sure what you're about and what works for you, it can be incredibly challenging to be like, well, there's 50 options here. I've read all of it. It all makes sense. I can't do all of it, certainly, because they're too varied in the approach. And then, you know, you get stuck and you need somewhere. I mean, yeah, you need something where you can kind of just follow one direction, at least for a little bit, and make adjustments to your course as you go along, right? And so an embodied truth is certainly different from just conceptual knowledge. And I think that that's a hard lesson for people, because conceptual knowledge is easy. Living the truth is more difficult. It's not like, you know, impossible or whatever, but it certainly takes a different level of commitment and dedication, and perhaps it's not even at that level that it's just like the desire to do it and not just think about it, right? Because it's easy to get lost in your thoughts and just be like, oh, I wish things were like this or like that or whatever, and then someone comes along and they're like, hey, you know, you can do that if you want, you just have to, you know, do a bunch of other stuff first. Then that's when people go like, oh, I don't know if I want to change that much. Right?
Yeah. So
how do people like, well, I guess when people come to you, there's already that investment in change to some degree, right? They're looking for the support and they're looking for a way or a mentor or a teacher or something like that to help them. And so that's good, right? Because that means that you're not trying to, you know, convert people, so to speak, like onto your side. You're just sort of showing them the way. And it obviously works. I mean, you know, you have thousands of people who have, you know, loved the work that you've done, and that's amazing. And so whatever you're doing, it is going well and it works. And so how do you feel like, you know, people approach the situation? I mean, I guess we kind of touched on it a little bit, right? Do you find that most people find it very difficult to change?
By the time they get into my camp, they're usually so done with the way things have been and the way that they feel that they're willing to do what it takes to feel differently. And sometimes I'll say that often if we want to make a profound change in our life, either the pain has to be great enough like the way that things are has to hurt bad enough that we're willing to lose whatever it is that we're attached to so that we can actually create a change. Or the inspiration has to be loud enough. The why has to be big enough. I've definitely learned through the former a lot.
Right.
And I love to facilitate people growing through the latter, through inspiration and through, you know, their why becoming so powerful for them that they're willing to grow out of the ways that they've been. But, you know, we're human beings on this path of really discovering ourselves and what's true for us and what feels inspiring to us and really uncovering the ways that we are, that we're identified with, that are actually ways that we're surviving planet Earth and not totally true to our core nature. And, you know, I find that people are magnetized to my work because I just really enjoy looking at that process and being a part of it myself. And so a lot of the pains and like sticky points and just, and the beauty and the joy of being a human, you know, I like to make room for all of that. Right. So we need to be like whole beings on this journey together. And you know, what comes up for me when you were sharing what you were sharing about how it is really often challenging for people to actually do anything different because they do read all of these books and it's like, okay, well, here's 12 different strategies. I can't do them at the same time because some of them counter each other. And where do I even start? Where mm-hmm. do I go? Like the spiritual and personal development buffet is so rich. It's huge and it's endless. And that's great. And it can be overwhelming and paralyzing for some people. I see that absolutely. And I think I've been there too. And so what I often encourage people to do is go by resonance, go by, you know, their intuitive nudge. And if they have no idea what that even is yet, because sometimes we don't, just taking the sacred scientist approach, you know, where I'm like, okay, I don't actually know if this method is going to work. I don't know if yoga or meditation or this mindset practice is actually going to deliver a result, but I'm willing to try it just mm-hmm. to experiment. So can I try this practice on for a month or 2 months or 3 months? 3 months out of my whole life is not that long, and see what happens. And if something changes, great. And if it doesn't, I'll just drop it and try the next thing. And so instead of being in this culture where we need a quick fix, being in a place of curious discovery of what actually works for me and the way that I want to live and, you know, the trauma that I carry and the patterns that I'm repeating, like that's, in my experience, a much lighter way to go around growth and transformation and, you know, spiritual expansion. And, you know, unfortunately, what we're taught goes counter to all of that. It's take a pill for that, or, you know, do this thing. We're so oversold, especially in the West, on the quick fix, that the idea of having the courage to like truly make a new choice for yourself every day for 3 months feels like this overwhelming feat that we could never accomplish, when really, like, it's not that hard. Like, humans are so powerful and we're so resilient. When we really think about what people have been through in this life, like, humans have overcome tremendous amounts of adversity and pain and challenge, and we make it. And so we do actually have the power to make new choices.
It absolutely.
It takes courage, it takes commitment, and often it takes like doing the opposite of what we're told our whole life growing up.
Right. And it's so true. Like, you know, the amount of shit that humans go through, everyone just about, is astounding. And our adaptability to any sort of challenge or difficulty that life presents us, of which everyone will get their fair share, you know, it's a true testament to humanity, or, and, you know, sort of just the universe or life itself, that through this enormous facing of these difficulties, we grow and we evolve and we become better, and, you know, we move towards greater good, you could say. And I really liked your idea of the sacred scientist, because it takes the approach of like, I don't know what the right answer is, but I'm willing to try and hypothesize and see what works and what doesn't work, with the understanding ahead of time that this may or may not work for me. But if it does work, that's magical, right? And it's transformational and it's huge. And if it doesn't, okay, I learned some stuff. You know, I tried something new. That was good for me. I got more into the habit of doing things that I haven't done before, or trying new things. And, you know, we tend to be pretty aversive towards that a lot of the time for some reason. We like to, you know, just keep things the way they are. And as you say, like, it actually doesn't take that much. It feels like it does. And it's really weird to like have to fight with yourself about doing 10 minutes a day of something. And, you know, and there's so many days, especially in the beginning, where you're not going to do it, whether it's a meditation or a yoga exercise or something like that. It's really weird that, you know, we feel like we don't have 10 minutes in the day. And I mean, obviously we do. We have plenty of time. We just choose to occupy ourselves with other things rather. And I think it's because there's that initial learning curve that's challenging and difficult that we avoid. You know, it's better to be comfortable in your sort of misery than to push and challenge yourself to try something new, because it's hard, and because learning new things, even things that are peaceful things like meditation or yoga, like, it does take effort. You know, it very rarely happens by accident. And so it you know, as you had said earlier, like, well, sometimes people need to reach that point where they're like, something has to change. Like, this is not an option anymore. Like, I don't like how things are, and I'm willing to do whatever it takes to give it a try, to do something, because, you know, the sort of how things are going sucks and I don't want it like this anymore. Yeah.
And the mind is built to resist change.
Like, yes.
According to the mind, the number one goal of life is to stay alive. And so if you start to do anything different at all, it's like risking death to the mind. And so it's not that you suck or you don't want to change or you're lazy or you just can't meditate. It's that if you present the mind with a growth opportunity, it's designed to say, nope, that's dangerous. I know that if I keep doing the same thing that I've always done, I'll probably survive because I'm alive right now, which means that everything I've done up to this point has contributed to my current state of not dead.
Yeah.
So, you know, the mind doesn't really care if you are thriving or feeling alive in your body or experiencing joy or deep connection. The mind's goal is survival. And thank God that it is, you know, there's beauty in that as well. However, you know, we often choose the hell that we know because it feels actually safer. And so that goes all the way down to, you know, the addiction that some of us have to our own traumas. Like, I'm this way. I'm a depressed person. I'm a broken person. I'm a lazy person. I'm an overachiever. There's all of these different identities and ways of being that we addict ourselves to because it's the way that we've gotten love. You know, mm-hmm. If we got love by being someone who is good at everything, then we're likely not willing to fail at anything. If we have gotten love by being the squeaky wheel and always being pain so that someone comes to our rescue, we're very unlikely to feel comfortable with the idea of actually being free of our pain because we're afraid that the love will stop coming. And then what? And so there's so much going on underneath the surface of our resistance to change. It's actually quite human to resist change. But so many people feel alone in that. They think that everyone else has an easy time meditating, but I'm the one who's having a hard time. Every single person who comes through my program learns a meditation practice if they don't already have one. And the thing I hear the most is either I tried meditating and I suck at it. I'm like, yeah, everyone sucks at it. Everybody. That's just how it is. And, you know, I've meditated every day for a year and a half, and mostly every day for much longer than that. And there are days where it feels like it's almost impossible for me to sit down in silence with myself. And I've done it hundreds and hundreds of times. There's still resistance there, and it's the willingness to sit through it that's the gift. And, you know, I make the joke. The other one is time. Like you said, I don't have time to meditate. And I'm like, you don't have time not to.
Yeah.
And there's a saying that one of my meditation teachers offered me, and it's, if you don't have time to meditate for 5 minutes, sit for 20. And if you don't have time to sit for 20, sit for an hour. And so there are days where I'm like, oh, I just can't. And I'm like, wow, Nina, yeah, you can, and you're going to. And I know the benefit that it delivers my life. And so it's easier for me at this point to do the thing because I know that it works. But in the beginning, we don't know that it works. And so it's like, how could I waste 20 minutes of my life for something that doesn't have a guaranteed result? My mind doesn't know. But once you get over that hump, you really know the difference between a day where you have meditated and a day where you have not. And then it becomes easier. Even if the experience of it is challenging, the willingness to sit becomes much more, you know, it comes more naturally because you know that there's an immediate benefit to your nervous system, to your brain, to your mood, your physical body. I mean, literally every part of your life is touched by meditation. So
yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's particularly the case, you know, why I would imagine it's difficult for people is because, well, if you think about it, you were like, well, you've done, you know, 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 years of no meditation, so to speak. And now you're a year in and you're like, how come, you know, it's still difficult? And it's like, well, because what do you mean? How come it's so difficult? Your whole life's been completely different. And now you're trying to make this enormous change to, you know, the way you think and be in the world. It's going to take some time, you know, like it doesn't just happen. Although I suppose there are some of those like miraculous cases of things that just sort of like switch. But, you know, I don't know if people know what they're saying when they're like, I wish that would happen to me, because then it's kind of like, well, yeah, but you got to go through a lot of shit to get there. And, you know, are you going to make it through that? That's questionable, you know, like you don't know exactly what you're wishing for when you wish for other people's lives, you know. It's better to just see what you can do and just embrace all of it, you know, as part of the learning experience and the journey of life in its, you know, multifaceted manifestation. It's an extraordinary place to be, and to just give yourself the permission to try and to see what happens. And I mean, there's no downside to it, right? At least with like meditation, as an example, like what's the downside? You didn't go on your phone for 20 minutes. That's what you're missing out on. Like, that's not exactly like, you know, it's not ruining your life or whatever it is. But so, you know, there's certainly like this sense of needing to find your true or authentic self in all of this, right? Like, what resonates with you? What do you want? What feels good for you? And just trying to figure that out, which will be different for different people because we're such different creatures, even though we're very similar, our sort of unique manifestations and characteristics mean that the way we do things differ. And so, you know, how do you coach people into finding their truth or their authenticity or however you phrase it?
Yeah, I mean this is
it's a big question, but just, you know, like a sort of intro.
Yeah, it really sits at the core of what I do is, just like you said, create permission for people to actually be on that journey home to themselves and for whatever occurs along that journey to actually be an important part of the journey. You know, people are like, where's my path? What's my path? I'm like, you're on it. You can't be off your path. It's your path. You're literally on it right now. It couldn't be any different. So most often we come to this question, this inquiry of what is my authentic truth? Who am I? What do I actually want for myself in this life? What feels true for me later? Like, we come to these questions usually in our 30s or later. Some of us, some of the kids now are starting to ask these bigger questions a lot younger. I don't think I really got to that place until my early 30s where I was genuinely asking the question. I thought I was asking it before, but what I was really asking was, who should I be so that I can blank? Mm-hmm. And that's what most of my life was. And it's what most of a lot of our lives are, is I'm going to be the class clown because if I make people laugh, they'll love me. I'm going to be the star athlete, one, because I have talent, and two, because people will love me if I win and if I perform well. I'm going to be the smartest person in the room because I'm intelligent and because that's how I get approval. And so most of us are often becoming aware of our strengths and then using those to get love. And then often we get to a point where, like, we've grown. And the thing that we did to get love doesn't actually feel fun for us anymore. It doesn't feel true for us. And then we're adults and we're like, okay, well, if this thing, this way of being, this role, this mask, this identity that I've played for most of my young adulthood doesn't feel like it's true for me anymore, what is true for me? And, you know, there's a lot of talk around, like, be your authentic self. But what I see in most adults is they have no idea who that is, because we've been playing a role in order to get safety, approval, like ability, partnership, love, money, you name it. We're trying to get all the things that we think we want. And then often we get them and we realize that, like, none of that was the point. And then we want to be the truth of who we are. And so really guiding people to their truth in my work and in my experience is actually being like a shepherd and, you know, a cheerleader sometimes, and like an oracle for people who are willing to go on the journey of discovering themselves. It's not a destination, it's a life path. I'm going to discover the truth of who I am moment by moment by moment. And I'm going to do that through presence and through freedom and through expressing my authentic truth in this moment now, which might be different than who I am in 5 minutes or tomorrow.
Yeah, because, you know, there's certainly that sense of like a need for a description, right? Which doesn't help. Of like, oh, I need to be able to describe who I am or what I want, or, you know, sort of any big life questions that often don't really have answers other than, well, it is exactly as it is right now. And that's basically what you got, right? The rest of it's just mental projections into the past or into the future, about other people, about yourself, about the world. You know, as you say, like, everyone's looking for love and approval, and you sort of try and fill these roles that you think will get you there. And, you know, what came to mind for me was like, I was wondering if back in the day, so to speak, not that long ago, but, you know, there's this sort of pop psychology notion of this like midlife crisis that happens to people, right? And you sort of typically think of it as people in their 40s or 50s or something like that. And that they sort of reach a point where they're successful in whatever career they've done. You know, they maybe they have a family, or they've sort of checked the boxes that they think they're supposed to work towards to check to find that happiness. And then they reach that point and they're like, oh, something's still missing, right? And then they go buy a motorcycle or a boat or a, you know, whatever it is, right? It could be a bit more destructive than that. But I wonder if, like, the access to information that's in the world today has brought that down by age significantly, at least for some, not everyone, obviously, you know, just for some people. But it's like, well, because now you have access, we all have access to all kinds of people that in the world who are actually telling you these kinds of messages. And if you're young and you're listening, then it's like, oh, well, you can kind of, you can avoid 20 years of trying if something in you can see through that, right? Not guaranteed, but Would you think that that's like perhaps why things are happening at earlier stages these days?
I am watching the self-realization process occur younger because we're evolving.
Mm.
And like, that's just how it is. You know, what I know about trauma and the brain and healing is profoundly different than anything my parents had access to. And so, you know, we're evolving both from a, you know, we understand what's occurring in the human body as a result of the experiences that we've been having. We have tools to heal it. And we're also evolving spiritually. We're waking up. We are shifting so profoundly. If you look at the way the kids care about planet Earth, like when I was young, I had no idea the effect that plastic was having on the ocean. And if I did, I would have been very different. And so, you know, we're evolving and that's having an effect on it. And, you know, with the access to self-expression and the celebration of self-expression that we have, you know, social media has definitely crippled us in a lot of ways, but there's some liberation in that as well. And there's actually an astrological explanation for the midlife crisis. I believe that it's Uranus that comes around, like our Uranus return is around that time. And it is a moment where we kind of come back around to like, wait, what has this whole thing been about? And it is the exact experience that you described. But we also have like the Saturn return, which happens like 27 to 30. It's 28 and a half is like when it actually happens. But for most people I know, like 27 to 30 is like this time of reckoning where you're not quite like a real adult, but you're definitely not a kid anymore. And you start to question everything you've done up to this point. Almost every person who's about to turn 30 I've ever met has this feeling of, oh, I should have done all this stuff already. Or, you know, I did all this stuff and what was the point of it? There are moments of like reckoning
mm-hmm.
in the human journey. And, you know, we explain them through astrology or through self-discovery or, you know, evolution. And in my experience and the way that I witness things is that's part of the fun. You know, if we knew everything and if we had all the tools and we knew the exact path straight to truth and there were no distractions, what would the point of this be? You know, we're wandering through a rose garden. It's not linear. And the things that we learn and gather and bump up against, as horrifying as some of them may be, shape us. And they shape the way that we meet each other. They shape our connections. They create resilience. They create courage. You know, when I go through something that's really challenging and I end up more wise and more compassionate on the other side, at one point I will thank spirit for that experience because it is a part of who I get to be now. And if I love who I get to be now in this moment, which I hope we all get to at some point, then I actually really appreciate all of the adversity and the growth and, you know, the muck that I had to walk through in order to get here. And so, you know, I don't think we're meant to have all the answers or to be asking the big questions right away. I think we're kind of meant to like stumble a little bit and dust ourselves off and tend to our wounds and have the gifts to give each other as we walk ourselves home. And we're all walking each other home, really. That's like part of the fun.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, it's so true how the most challenging and often painful experiences end up being the most profound and meaningful to people, right? Even though at the time it sucks and it is painful, or, you know, however it sort of manifests, or you're pricking yourself on the roses in the garden or whatever it is, it's like, yeah, but that's how it goes, you know? And the people who have the most compassion are often the ones who have also had the most suffering, right? Because they know what others, or they can see or feel exactly what's happening in other people, right? Such that they've been through it themselves, and so they're like, ah, I get what's happening here. And it's not from a level of judgment or conceptualization or any sort of mental aspect of it. It's simply that recognition of like, I know your pain, and I'm, you know, perhaps not in a position, oh, I've come through it on the other side, so I can be in a position now to walk you through or provide you the support or just be there or nothing, perhaps at all. Like, maybe that's the answer, because, you know, not everyone's willing to, not everyone wants help or whatever it is, and that's fine. But that allows you to be compassionate for everyone, just about, you know, even people who are so-called evil in the world. Like, truly, if you look past that kind of stuff, you can have compassion for everyone, because everyone's just trying to survive, as you say. That's the main thing. Do the best they can and, you know, find some sense of themselves, and they're looking for themselves or what they think that they should be looking for. And, you know, people do it through all kinds of weird ways that have often very, you know, negative consequences for others, which is, I mean, that's just how it is. But there's certainly that level of authenticity and compassion that comes through suffering. And so when we reach a point where you can see that, firstly, it's easy to see in other people, right? You can see, and you can see the transformation in other people. You can be like, oh, I see that person suffered this, and then afterwards they came out good on the other side, and now they're helping people with it. That's one way. But when you go through it and you come out on the other side, that's when you have that like embodied wisdom of it, right? And then to be able to take that approach during the time of your current suffering, that's the next level, so to speak, where you can then welcome the suffering, or the difficulty perhaps is a better word, or challenge in your life as it's happening, and not be so resistant to it. And that actually decreases the suffering almost entirely. And then there's just some pain or some discomfort or some uneasiness or some, you know, fluctuating emotions and mental games and things like that. But you can allow that to be, because there's that sense of connectedness to a sort of larger picture where you can say, oh, I don't know why this is happening to me right now, right? But what I do know is that ultimately it'll probably be beneficial, even if I can't see it right now. And that's, I think, is a huge part for people, right? To be able to deal with whatever shit they're going through at any given point.
Yeah. I mean, that's freedom.
Yeah.
You know, there's a point of acceptance and openness we get to where the stories about what we're experiencing start to dissolve. And all sensation, all emotion, all feeling is just another feeling of aliveness. You know, the meditators talk about this, the place of equanimity, where even pain, sadness, despair, grief, anger, all of it is another part of being alive. And the part of it that is suffering is not actually the emotion or the experience itself. It's the collapsing down around it, and it's the resistance to feeling what's there. When we close and shut down, less energy is able to move through our channel. And so we end up prolonging pain and prolonging suffering. You know, if we're not willing to express our anger and to give it a home, it starts to create liver disease and pain in our body. And, you know, this is what makes us sick, when really these are beautiful parts of the human experience. It's just that we grew up in a world that says your anger is dangerous. No one wants your sadness. Just get over it. Like, that's not true for anyone. And, you know, being in a world where deep emotion is unfavorable, if it's on that end of the spectrum, you know, that's why we're not healthy as a society. And I agree with you that the truth of every single one of our hearts is innocent. Even people who are doing really horrifying things in the world and we go, oh my gosh, like that person is evil. How could they? You know, when I look at those people who are abusing the planet or humans or animals or whatever it might be, I see somebody who is so deeply entrenched in pain that they feel like they have no way out. And to express power over another or abuse, that's the only way they have any sense of self or, you know, aliveness. Or they've gone so numb that they have to, you know, do this, that, or the other thing to feel like they're even here at all. And that doesn't make someone evil. It makes them pain and traumatized. And the compassion comes exactly as you described it, not because we're empathic and we can feel other people's pain, and not only from experiencing pain ourselves. You know, there are people who have experienced a lot of pain who aren't compassionate. And that's because they're not compassionate for themselves first. It really takes a willingness to forgive ourselves and a willingness to see our own innocence in order to offer that true embodied compassion to another. And so if someone like me, who has, you know, spent a lot of time and energy forgiving myself and coming to terms with a lot of the trauma that I've experienced, and having compassion for myself and the experiences that I'm having that are not preferred, you know, I can witness somebody in extreme pain or in a pattern or who's done something really shitty and now they feel terrible about it. You know, I can look at that person and have such deep and profound compassion for them, but it's only because I was willing to give that to myself. Compassion's a vibration. And so if we're not willing to give ourselves that compassion, we can't actually offer it. A lot of people will come to me and say, like, oh, I have such an easy time having compassion for others, but I can't have compassion for myself. And I'm like, not true. You cannot truly be compassionate for others if you're not compassionate for yourself. You're acting like you're compassionate for others because you want to be a kind person, but compassion is a vibration. We have to be at a level of compassion in order to offer a level of compassion, which means, like, I can't hand you this pen if I don't have a pen. Like, right. I have to have that first. And so, you know, a lot of the, like, overgiver, they think they're being generous when really they're giving to receive. They're giving because they think it's the only way to get. And if you say that to an overgiver, they'll be like, oh my gosh, no, it's not. I would never. But I'm like, what's sitting underneath that is lack. It's a need for love. And it's a really human need for love. We're allowed to have needs.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of this is like, it's dissolving the way that we're taught things should be and coming to terms with like the truth of our experiences and the innocence in that.
Yeah, and also, you know, that allowing yourself to feel compassion for yourself, or, I mean, that's not the right way to say it, but being compassionate for yourself is, it's weird for us in this world, and, you know, like, it shouldn't be. You would imagine it to be a natural, just a sort of natural way of being, right? Like, it's always amazed me how, like, people, including myself, like, I'm not excluding myself out of this, it's like how we don't take care of ourselves. And it's just, it's very strange. I'm like, do you see the dog that hates itself? No. What, you know, that doesn't make any sense. You know, does it do things to harm itself intentionally, you know, while at the same time sort of just pretending like it's not happening, or, you know, trying to, like, fix the world to, like, make itself feel better? Or it's like, no, that shit doesn't happen at all. And we're just somewhat of a slightly more advanced species than dogs. We're not that much, you know. We have a bigger prefrontal cortex, so we can think about the shit. That's the difference. And we've caused ourselves all this suffering by trying to figure out what we should be, or, you know, the best way to do things, or trying to analyze problems from 10 or 20 or 1,000 different ways to give ourselves the best chance at achieving whatever we think we need. And yeah, you know, it comes back to that same point about needing, you know, like, needing love or needing acceptance, or just feeling okay with what is in the world, right? And, like, feeling like enough, Because a lot of it is that, as you said, that sense of lack, right? Like something's missing. And whether you think that that something is another person or more money or a different house or a different car or a particular whatever. I mean, there's any number of things that we often sort of think we need to be happy. And then, I mean, we're sort of circling back, right? It's like, well, when you get that stuff, it'll make you happy sort of for a little bit, maybe. And then at some point you'll be like, oh, but something's still missing. So either you want more now because you're going to try and refill that hole again, or you're going to look for something else to do or figure it out somewhere else. And then ultimately it just comes back to that same thing where it's like, well, if you can just be okay with just be okay with the present moment, right? Then you're actually okay. And then things are fine most of the time. Life's not that challenging moment to moment. You know, there's a lot of waiting that we do in the world, for example. But we spend our time worrying instead of just being. And I mean, you know, that's the downside of having such a big prefrontal cortex, is we have the ability to do such silly things to ourselves. But it is strange to watch animals and imagine them doing human-like behaviors. And it's like, it's very peculiar. But it's a challenge, right? And that's our challenge as a species, is to move through that shit.
Yeah, I was actually watching a TV show, which I rarely do, the other night. And one of the characters, who's supposed to be a demon in this show, says, you know, humans only live around 80 years and they spend most of it waiting for something to be over. Yeah. And I just laugh. I'm like, that's hell, you know, not being present, really. And being in this hamster wheel of trying to achieve fulfillment from the external world through success or partnership or whatever other, you know, like you said, the house, the car, the person, the job, the status, nothing will ever provide the sense of wholeness that you're looking for other than being so fully at peace with yourself in the present moment. Because even for those of us who get really good at that game, at winning the game of life, which was me, you know, I woke up one day and I had the coolest job I could imagine, a great partner, a beautiful apartment, a good salary. I was traveling constantly, amazing friends. You know, I'm considered attractive by traditional societal standards. And I looked around and I'm just like, okay. Yeah, none of this actually fulfills me at all. I'm grateful for it and I know how privileged I am. And this is not it. It's not the thing. And when we're actually looking for that sense of completion and wholeness, it's completion and wholeness by remembering ourselves as God, really. It's remembering that we're not separate from the whole. Mm-hmm. And you can call that God or spirit or oneness or consciousness or whatever you want to label it as. But it doesn't come from another person or a job or a thing. Because that thing can go away. You know, I've been in a relationship where I felt so completed by another. And I thought that if I stayed with this person, I'll be happy forever and I don't care about anything else because he is the world to me. And then he broke up with me, like out of nowhere. And I thought that I was going to die because I had wrapped my worth so deeply into an external source. And then when he left, it felt like my legs had been cut off. And that was when I realized, oh, I actually don't get to feel complete in anything outside of myself because it can go away. You can get fired from your dream job. Your business that you built that you love so much could get tanked by the economy, by forces that are totally out of your control. And even if your soulmate partner loves you more than anything in the world, they might not ever leave you, but they could get hit by a bus tomorrow and then they're gone. And then what? And so like that wholeness has to come from within, and you're never actually separate from it. We just think that we are. And so the game of awakening, of wholeness, of peace, of oneness is really not a getting. It's not an attaining. It's a remembering. It's a putting back together that which already exists, because we can't be without it. We just think that we are.
Yeah. And the thinking's the problem, right? And the thinking's the problem. Again, it's like, it's, you don't have to, I mean, it, I think, you know, you said it so wonderfully of just like, everything that you think externally could fulfill you might a little bit, but it can also be taken away, and probably will at some point, because life's about, you know, growth and decay, and things come into existence and they go out of existence, just about everything, except perhaps existence itself. So, I mean, that's a bit more of a problematic question, but we won't try to figure that one out with the mind. But the point I was sort of just wanting to say was that, like, you know, this deep truth that people are looking for, the irony of it is that you think you're trying to find it, or you, I mean, you're not, you don't think you're trying to find it, you do try and find it, but you try and find it through the mode of thinking, because that's sort of our default mode, right? But rarely, it's when you can step out of that and just be as a living being, or as a manifestation of consciousness or of God in the world, without conceptualizing it in some way or other, either as even as something as simple as good or bad, or this is it or this is not it. Those are all judgments on things. And, you know, you take all that away, which surprisingly is easy to do, and it happens multiple times throughout the day for most people. It's just that your mind doesn't pay attention to that, because it's not really memorable, and it doesn't really contribute to what the mind wants to think about its problems and, you know, how it's going to solve shit. It's like, no, there are these just moments of thoughtlessness, you know, which I guess in some traditions is called Zen or mindfulness or whatever, right? It all different words for the same sort of state of being. I mean, and it's really, that's the whole point of meditation. At least it's one of the points, is to be able to just recognize this natural state within yourself when it happens, right? And so the process of meditation, a lot of the time, at least in my experience, is just to sit or lie or stand and or do what, or walk or whatever you're doing, and just notice the moments in between the thoughts, right? And that's where you sort of start to see what's truly there, right? Because it's not clouded by the thoughts. And then afterwards, it's fine to have thoughts. They can come and they can go and they can do their thing. But that investment in the sense of self in the thinking isn't there anymore, right? And it's just, it's, you know, I guess we're at that point of like human evolution where this is really sort of taking a widespread hold of people. You know, before it was sort of a select few people or some monks here and there or some nuns here and there. And, you know, they did their thing and they kept a lot of the ancient wisdom traditions alive for thousands of years. And that's wonderful. And that's why we have them today still. But there's a really huge push now, it seems, as perhaps more people sort of gain more things in the world and realize that they're relatively empty, we have more time to think about shit. And so on the one hand, there's a lot of time to think about your problems, but on the other hand, it presents an amazing opportunity to move past that, right? And I guess that's why you do the work that you do.
Yeah, you know, the world's greatest sage, Ramana Maharshi, his entire body of work is based around the question, who am I? Mm-hmm. And it's not meant to get the mind to answer the question. It's, who am I beyond that? Who am I beyond that? Who am I beyond that? And the idea is that it eventually melts away the thinker entirely, and it grows that empty space. And, you know, the fun part about meditation is that once you cease thought and you're in that state of true peace and stillness and samadhi, the moment that you realize you were there is usually the moment that you're thinking about it again. And so we often don't get to bask in the stillness with the thinking about how we're in stillness, which is like the battle that we kind of do. But it grows that space. Like, you know, the more you are able to cultivate the space between thought, the more you grow a sense of inner peace in yourself that you actually carry all day. And so it's not just about the experience of meditation, which I find a lot of people get frustrated with. Their experience of meditation is frustrating, and so they don't want to do it. They think that meditation is supposed to feel peaceful from the jump, which is so not true. You start a meditation practice, and usually the first thing that happens is that all the stuff that you've been bottling up rises to the surface so that it can be witnessed and then dissolved. And it takes time to come to that place where you're actually experiencing the peace in your meditation practice. But the result happens immediately. You know, we don't need to meditate more than 3 minutes in order to experience a benefit. Like, it really does start to grow that place of inner peace and the dissolution of thought right away, and it changes our nervous system. And like, it, the profound effect that it has on our life, we get to actually witness that all day long, not just when we're in the practice, which is really exciting. You know, if we're willing to look for it, we're willing to treat this as something that is just part of our lifestyle, and we're looking for the ways that it's working.
Yeah.
And you know, there's a lot of, sometimes I just have to ask people, are you looking for what's wrong or are you looking for what's right? And this isn't to glaze over our challenges and our issues, but we also get to choose where to place our attention. And you know, it's more than just a law of attraction or manifestation 101. It's, are you actually willing to celebrate the moments where you do feel peaceful? And I think that, you know, what you described about how we hardly notice them because they're not as loud. You know, we're in a world where like extreme is something that catches our attention, and we're cultured that way, when often what we really want is to feel stillness and to feel peace. But our system has become so addicted to these extreme experiences, this big aliveness, this loudness, that we miss the beauty in the quiet moment of watching the wind blow through a tree, which is sometimes like one of the most profoundly beautiful experiences one can have, because nothing needs to happen. It just is. And if you can find joy in those moments, if you can let those moments of beauty and gratitude just fill you to the brim, then all of life gets to be a beautiful moment that's occurring right now, as opposed to this endless chase to fix my problems or get something.
Yeah. And it's, you know, again, we sort of get stuck at the language barrier where it's like, well, it makes sense that people would be like, oh, I want to try and do that now. And, you know, we run into that same thing of like, well, the thing is, it's sort of a relinquishing of trying. It's not really trying. It's just allowing and seeing rather than doing anything, which is really weird. It's kind of, it's paradoxical, I guess, but, you know, life is quite paradoxical, generally speaking. And so that's okay. And it is. And being able to just see those moments, I mean, in all of just sort of, you know, there's sort of a million different expressions that people try and say this truth of like, you know, what's it say? Something about smelling the roses or appreciate the little things or just whatever. Stop and smell the roses is the expression, you know, what and watch the trees. I mean, and it's so true, and it can be so profoundly transformational, even just those moments. But you shouldn't try and do it for the sake of the transformation, because then you're again trying stuff. But like, I had a really wonderful professor on the podcast the other day, and he spoke about this experience that he had one day just walking in the midst of like complete turmoil in his life, right? And he was just walking, and all of a sudden he kind of like focused in on this birds sitting in a tree, and he just looked, and you know, he wasn't interpreting or judging, he was just looking and listening. And for some reason, this moment had a complete transformation of how he experienced the world from then on. And he's actually a professor of biblical studies. So it was really interesting to hear from him, because he had spent like 15 years teaching biblical studies much more academically. And then he had this experience. And then all of a sudden he was starting to teach biblical studies from a deeper place, right? Where it was less about the words and more about the essence of the teachings. And this was all from a... It's just this on a random day, well, random, on a particular day, you know, he just had this transformational experience that he wasn't trying for, he didn't ask for, he wasn't, you know, meditating, he wasn't doing anything, he was in a really rough spot in life, you know, he was going through a lot of shit, and it just happened, and it was like magic, and now he's written this wonderful book about it, and that's the kind of thing that can be so transformational for people. And so, you know, it's so important. And I think out of that same consciousness, out of that same God, like, that's what the stuff that you're doing is, right? And I suppose to some degree, I'm also in one way or other with the podcast, but, you know, yours is a lot more focused and, you know, probably more beneficial to people. but yeah.
Who knows? You know, I'm sure someone will land upon your podcast and something will be shared that's the exact medicine they needed in that moment. So
I hope so, I suppose. I hope to bring some good to the world. That's the goal. But so your book, right? Empowered, Courageous, and Free, right? How has that been for you? Was that a good process? Did you enjoy writing it? Have you found it to be helpful for people? I'm sure it's gotten wonderful reviews.
Yeah, I co-authored this book with 6 other women. And nice. When I signed up for the process, I had no idea just how much writing it would actually be. You know, I'm a writer and I love to write. And I've been writing for social media for almost 10 years, like 7 years. And so everything that I've been writing, I condense as much as possible. And I really just try to give the most potent and necessary pieces of my own journey, of what I've acquired, my wisdom, you know, whatever little nuggets I find along the way. And I remember submitting my first draft to the editor and she was like, more, 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 more. And there was this part of me that thought, what do you mean more? Do people care about more? Does anyone actually want to read the deeper detail of this experience that I went through? Like, they don't care. They just want like what's in it for them. So let me just give them like the lesson I experienced as a result of this. And that's what they can apply. And so I learned a whole other medicine of storytelling and that, you know, people actually do want to be in the experience with you. They want to go on a journey with you and live through your experience, which is different than the way that I teach, right? Like when I teach in my group, I don't give people every detail of my own life because that's not what they're there for.
Right.
And so I went through the process of writing it, and it was actually shortly after a lot of what I was writing about had happened. And so I wrote about heartbreak and the death of my best friend that was unexpected and he was really young. And it was only it was 2 months after he died that I started this process. And so it was very raw and really healing for me to go into such detail through the art form of writing to share this experience and how it had shaped me. And then we get to the book launch event and I held the book in my hand and all of a sudden I was like, oh, people are going to read this. And it was like I hadn't even considered that that was a part of what I was doing until I was about to go speak in front of hundreds of people about the story that I had just written about my own life. And I was like, oh no, like I've named people in this book and they're going to read it and their families are going to read it. And, you know, it was this whole experience. And as I've become friends with many writers since, they can relate that you don't even really think about the part where others are going to read it until it's time for them to read it. And then it's this whole other thing that you get to move through as a writer.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was really fun. And I hope to write a full book at some point very soon. I have pieces of one put together, multiple. But it is really fun to know that I'll have that forever, and that when I'm a grandma, I get to, you know, hold this piece of art that I got to create as a young adult and share it.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. And I'm sure it's done really good things for people. Everyone can always benefit from, you know, these kinds of stories and hearing what real people go through and just being a part of that journey. And so, you know, for anyone who's listening, who's interested in buying the book, I will put a link to it. Make sure that you go and purchase it. I've really enjoyed this conversation with you today, and I thank you very much for coming on the podcast. Is there anything that you would like to plug, your website or social media stuff? What would you like to promote?
Yeah, if anyone out there is resonating with what I've shared and some of the perspectives that I have to offer, I would love to connect with you on Instagram. So that's really a fun place where I get to know people and share a lot. I share a lot on Instagram, a little bit less than normal lately. But I really enjoy having this like free open space where we get to connect and witness each other no matter where we are in the world. So I think Amazing. It can be used as a beautiful tool and not just the black mirror that we get sucked into.
Yeah.
So you can find me on Instagram at It's Nina Camille. So my handle is ITSNINACAMILLE. And I'm sure you'll be able to post the link in there as well.
Of course. Yeah.
And yeah, anything else that anyone needs to know about working with me can be found through social media too. So
fantastic. Well, thank you again. I hope to have you on again sometime soon in the future. Have another great conversation. There's lots to discuss. But until then, yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, take care.